Kenny. I'm an alcoholic. Great job, Bill. And it's really a great format, I think, for the Seattle meeting. I got my copy of our stories disclosed out before this meeting today and read the first 24 pages, which is kind of about the history of how AA got started in Seattle and the Seattle group, and which I think started in March 1941, if I remember from my reading today. But one of the things that wasn't in there was that I think it's such a great format because in the old Oxford group meetings, which they were kind of, you know, flying along and trying, a lot of what we have came from the Oxford group. And one of the things the Oxford group members used to do is they'd always put the guy with the newest experience up front. They weren't alcoholics with the newest sobriety, but the guy with the newest spiritual experience, they wanted to hear from that guy first. They put him up front because he was the closest they felt to God. And so, Bill, you know, that was a fine AA talk, and congratulations on your 95 dates. And it really touched my heart, too, just to see a new guy talk about the obsession, you know, that magic when the obsession leaves us. So, and there's, you know, this is what an amazing little group of people we have here for me to come speak. So I just would, you know, I've got so many friends and old friends. It's so great to see you. And my friend Gretchen, who was in my life in AA and who I drank with before I got to AA, which I've been sober since June the 8th of 1989, 32 years. And now she's here with 8 years, and I haven't seen you during that whole time for today. It took me a while, and I finally was across to you, and I just said, "Oh my God, Gretchen." And she said, "Yes, I was hoping to be recognized." And my friend Steve and Jeffrey, who are here, Jeffrey and I spent a lot of time in the step work. He was the very first guy I ever did a fist step with, a real fist step. I had a sponsor at the time, but he and I were like flying by the seat of our pants back then. You know, he was 13 years sober, but he'd never really worked the steps, albeit at that time in his life. And one of the miracles of being sober a while is that I've changed a huge amount since my first day of sobriety to this 32 years later. My life continues to have these major changes in place, and so did Al's. You know, he is quite a different person than he was 32 years ago. And so we just had a party for him. Our birthdays are both in June. We just had a party for him at my house, and he was 45 years sober now. And we've been, you know, that journey together, the same kind of journey Jeffrey and I and Steve and I have been on. And of course, you know, the mother of my daughter, Jessica Lara, to be here tonight and to be running in a group and stuff. What an incredibly special time that is. So that's great. And you know, our daughter is, I'll probably get this wrong. Our daughter's 29 years old, 28, 29. I got it right. So our daughter's 29 years old. And so we've, you know, had this experience for all these years. And then the experience that you brought up, you know, that was something. I got no idea where this is all going to go tonight. I really didn't plan much out for this talk intentionally. And I just wanted to get here, get a feel for the room, and kind of see who was here. But when I was about, maybe I was 8 years sober, 10 years sober or something, I ran across this woman that she mentioned, Darlene. And she had come to me, and she was having a psychotic break. As a matter of fact, she ended up at the Harborview Hospital on the floor where they help people who have had a psychotic break like that. And I just did what Bill's going to be doing with his sponsor here. They already started. They read for the first time. I just started opening the book and reading to her, and we did our first third step prayer over the phone, and she came out of that. And a few years. Later, you know, I fell in love with her son, Jake. You know, and I just kind of got this idea, like, maybe there's more to say thing. Maybe you are supposed to pay attention to the families. And I just fell in love with her son, Jake. I was getting tickets from my work for baseball games. We always went to baseball games, and I'd swing by and pick him up, take him out to dinner. And, you know, dinner for him, like the Olive Garden or something like that, that was like huge to him. You know, Darlene was poor as a church mouse, you know, and it was only by the graces of some people in AA that she got that little place, that little apartment. And, in Lake City where the two of them could live. And she just like went at this with this passion that I've never seen before and since, that somebody would have that dramatic of a change later in sobriety. She just lit up and literally people were booking her time like 15 minute increments. And it was so incredible the change that she went through when she went through the steps, that my wife, who I've now been married to for, will be married 23 years in next month. And my wife asked Darlene to be her sponsor. That's how big of a change it was. And when the first time I met Darlene, you know, she grabbed me by the collar at a retreat that I was helping to put on. She grabbed me by the collar like this and just was like, she knew that I was a guy that was working some steps and was in these workshops and stuff. And she just grabbed me just like, I need some help. And she showed up at this deal without, she showed up at the deal, she hadn't paid, she hadn't registered or anything. So everybody's like, and she was disrupting the speaker that was trying to do stuff. And it was just a real scene. And she asked me, you know, she asked me, I need some help. And I was like looking over this woman that's got me by the lapels. I'm looking over her trying to think, there must be somebody here that can help you. You know, this is too much for me and I'm gonna get a woman to help you. And my wife, Shannon, was standing next to me and she said, Kenny, you need to help this woman. She could see the selfishness go on, and that's how we got started. And this was in the days she had HIV, which turned into full-blown AIDS, and it was a time when there was really no solution to that. And many of us were at the hospital with her, you know, all the way up to it. And I was with her when she passed away. I was with her all those years. I heard many of her fist steps, and you know, she had fun. You know, she was boy crazy for these. She'd always have these, the guys, she would always have these tattooed, you know, just guys with, you know, piercings and young, way just totally like, you know, this is, you know, this guy's got like 3 days of sobriety. But that was Darlene, you know, bless her heart. But I was with her. I was with her son when she passed away, and you know, I was holding her hand when she took her last breath, and you know, the beautiful thing about AA was there was nothing between us except for the love of one alcoholic for another. That was it. That was our entire relationship. And I walked in there with her son, who'd been staying with me because his mom was in the hospital. And I walked in there with this kid to say goodbye to his mother. And I walked out of there with my son, Jake. And he's been with me ever since. And now, you know, Jake is 36 years old now. And he just called while I was sitting in the meeting. Jake just called me from Busan, Korea, where he's working right now, working on a ship. And he just called me to, you know, because, you know, he calls me his dad. I call him my son. And that's just, and the reason this was a 12-step call that I wanted to give to somebody else. And you know, you say, like, you said, I don't know what Darlene would have done without you. And you're grateful for that. And the thought that came to my mind, I don't know what I would have done without her and Jake. And people said, oh, Kenny, it's so great that you took Jake in and that you guys did this stuff for him. But it was just exactly the opposite of that deal. So, so I'll back up just for a minute here. You know, I came from an alcoholic home. And so prior to June 8th of 1989, when I got sober, we were talking about this a little bit in the car. You know, I grew up in Ballard, and my family was, my stepdad was the town drunk in Ballard, which in those days was really hard to get to be the main drunk in Ballard in those days. But he was the guy. You know, he was passed out on the lawn. The car was always up on the, you know, on the sidewalk in front of her house. You know, that's just the way I grew up. It was just this total insanity. And, you know, that, so I ended up in a lot of group homes and foster homes. And I started off from the time that I took my first drink around 12 years old, you know, I just, absolutely lit me up. Like there was a feeling that, you know, I belong to life at last. All of those kinds of things happened. Like just deep down within me, this feeling that, man, you know, this is, I can take a deep breath here. This is just unbelievable. And I went from that to, you know, it was like 1 year later, I was burglarizing houses to support my drug and alcohol habit. And I was getting arrested. And so I spent most of my, I was in foster homes and group homes and then institutions. And I spent my entire high school years, the years I should have been going to high school, I spent those years institutionalized and locked up. And every time I would get out, I would just go completely nuts. And I met a guy finally after years, I told this story, and I met a guy who said that he had the same story, but up to that point, I'd never heard of anything like it. But I was court ordered, mandated to take antabuse as a juvenile, because every time that they would let me out, they would try to get me out, and I would just be drunk somewhere, passed out, and the police would find me. And I would go to this pharmacy, and the pharmacist would give me my pill, and I would have to, he'd have to watch me and check my mouth and everything to make sure I'd swallowed it. And, you know, but the antabuse had no effect at all on all the drugs I was doing, so it really was not a major inconvenience for me. But, you know, that was the deal for me, and I had some success in my life, and my granddad had this great idea that if we put him on a ship going to Alaska, a fishing boat, he worked for a company that, a family that was fishing, had fishing businesses up in Alaska, and he worked for them. And then, so he got me in to go to Alaska on a fishing boat when I was 17 years old. And I just, you know, it sounds crazy that putting somebody on a boat going to Alaska in those days was the thing that was going to help them from alcoholism, because it was just off the hook, you know, uncontrollable. And I'm still in that business in a small way today, but, you know, the crews are all drug tested, and there's oversight, and Coast Guards coming on board checking before you can leave the dock and all those kinds of things. But they didn't have any of that back then. It was, you know, it was just this massive, massive party scene. And everybody on the boat was doing drugs, and everybody was drinking. But I absolutely fell in love with it. You know, I loved the mentorship of the older guys. I loved having men in my life that showed me how to work hard. I loved, you know, I just loved everything about it, like having some kind of an identity. But you know, I had some success in that, and then I just drank and drugged my way out of it. And the same guys that I was drinking with and doing drugs with were those same guys were the guys that put me through treatment twice. That the same guys, you know, put me through treatment two different times. Because there was something, you know, there was an urgency about the drink for me. You know, that the only reason I was living was to drink. And the only thing I could think of was this obsession that I had for more. And, you know, when that obsession is lifted from us, we get to find out kind of who we are, you know? And so, after they fired me, which was the second time I got out of treatment and showed up the day I got out of treatment, loaded out of my mind at their office asking them to front me some money, you know, I ended up homeless, and I was behind the McDonald's and this is the story that Austri was mentioning. I was behind, there was a little McDonald's restaurant on 85th, which is not there anymore. It was on Greenwood, just by 85th. And next to that was the Hagar's Tavern, the building where Hagar's Tavern still is, I think. But in between, it was a facade at the front, but in between, if you went around back, in between those buildings, there was actually two separate buildings and some space there. And, you know, so, and it was funny because, like, I think about this, like, back in those days, you had to hide your homelessness, you know? It was like, you know, you couldn't just, if I would have tried to pitch a tent, out on the green. They would have come and said, you're about 2 minutes from getting the smock beat out of you if you don't pack this tent up and move. You must have lost your goddamn mind. You couldn't do that stuff. But so I found this spot, and it was so beautiful back there because it was like 6 or 8 feet between the buildings, and you had to go up through some brush and stuff to get back in behind there. And then I found this huge piece of cardboard, like a refrigerator box, that I'd leaned up there. And I was in there, and I could hear the people going through the drive-thru. And what I hear him say, I have a number 3 supersized with a Diet Coke. And I, you know, come from this place as a kid, you know, where my last experience in school, I was going to junior high school, I was still wet in the bed, I smelled like urine, long hair was popular then, so I had really long hair, but I never didn't know, and, you know, I just wasn't in a family that taught us about hygiene and that kind of stuff, you know, and so I just wake up in the morning, I would just towel dry myself off the best I could. And then I would go through my dirty clothes pile and pile on, you know, I'd pick out the best, the cleanest of the dirty clothes. You know, I'd pick through there and find the things that were the cleanest out of the dirty clothes pile, put those on and try to go to school like that. And then in addition to that, I had this weird deal that I was in where I was trying to find any way to alter my mind, so I would choke myself until I was like almost gonna pass out, and then I would let go, and then I would kind of stagger around. And I didn't care at that point if my stepdad was yelling at me, he was gonna kick my ass or whatever the deal was. I was just, you know, in this like altered state for a few seconds. So when I went to school and I was stinking like urine and not showering and not brushing my teeth, and choking myself and staggering around, my popularity began to wane just a little bit. So I had this view of myself as this just total freak. And so when I was behind the McDonald's there, they'd order that number 3 supersized with a Diet Coke, and I thought, I kept hearing them say, hey, there's a freak back here shooting Coke. And that's all I would just hear them. And you know, it's like a jumpy way to live, because it was just kind of like, over and over and over again, and then sometimes they would say, there's a freak back here, so you call the FBI. And then I would be like, oh my God, man, the FBI, now they've got the FBI. And I would swear to God, I was sober a while before I really realized that the FBI delegates like flushing homeless people out from behind McDonald's. They delegate that to some lower authority. Actually, the FBI goes after that kind of cases. It's more like the assistant general manager of the McDonald's gets assigned that kind of case, you know. But somehow, you know, I think about that, and I knew a guy that was going. I'd gone a few times to the AA hall, and I knew a few people that were going there. And I like got out from behind that McDonald's, and I there on the back porch of the hall there when it was at Greenwood Fellowship. The back hall, there was always a lot of people back there, and it was shared a parking lot, this U-shaped parking lot that was kind of the back of all of this complex. And they, so from any time I would come out from my spot, I could see over there, and I could see all the A people up on the deal, but I couldn't walk up through all those people, you know, I just couldn't do it. So I had to walk all the way around and came in the front door of that hall, which nobody ever did, because that just wasn't the deal. Everybody came in the back. Out of the back door. I came in the back deal, and it was a B1 meeting. It was a Thursday night at 8 o'clock. So if you were to look at your calendars from 1989, you'd find that June 8th was a Thursday. And that Thursday, that B1 meeting was going. It was an 8 o'clock meeting, and I walked in there, and I took a seat close to the door, and I just was in the meeting, and just something kind of overcame me. You know, the meeting ended, and I think I'd caused some scenes, you know, a few things. People call me down and go sit in your seat. But the meeting ended, and I just was like, I don't know what I'm going to do here. You know, I can't really go back, because I was in a place where if I stopped, I would get very, very sick. And I had no money, and I had nothing to keep me well, and I had no booze, and I just was like, you know, this is a horrible situation. And I've always felt like, you know, now that I got to know the program, like there's a part in this 10th step where they say that they use words like intuitive thought and inspiration and the vital sixth sense, you know, which is like these five senses that we have are great for some things, but they don't do you a lot of good in the spiritual life. You know, you gotta, and so I got to meet people that were operating from that place. And my sponsor, Al B, came up to me after the meeting, a guy that I'd never met, came up to me and said, listen, my friends and I have been talking, and if you'd be willing to go to detox, we'll give you a ride. And matter of fact, we've already made some phone calls, and they got a bed for you. And so I, you know, was like, well, first of all, how does this guy know I need to go to detox? I thought I was hiding it a little better. And the craziest thing about it was that I had a bag with me that night, and in that bag was, you know, all my prized possessions, which, you know, some hypodermic needles and some, you know, some things I'd stolen, a couple things I'd stolen from the stores, and then, and my shoes. And the reason I was sitting in Fremont Hall barefoot with no shoes on was because my feet had abscessed. And I had big abscesses on my feet, and my feet hurt, and I couldn't get my shoes on anymore. My feet were swelled up. And I'm sitting, I was 28 years old. And, you know, I just know with a certainty today that I know that I should have died behind that McDonald's. And yet somehow I got to come and, you know, be with you all for 32 years. And I've had a career, I've had, you know, I've had the ability to know what it's like to raise a child. I was with Lara when she gave birth to our daughter. To get to witness that, you know, and to, you know, our daughter was born at Ballard Hospital, and I can remember like looking out the window and seeing this cross. You know, it was really sobriety when I had that baby. And when I didn't have the baby, actually, just Lara had the baby. But, you know, it was really sobriety, but I just remember looking out the window and seeing this cross and just realizing, man, something dramatic has changed in my life. And then when Jeffrey told me, man, dude, you got to pay the money back, you know, go down there. And I, you know, when I would walk out of one of these stores that I had shoplifted from, you know, I'd walk in and tell them, I'm a member of AA in good standing. Just choking up to think about it, you know. I'm an A member in good standing, and for that reason, I've written an inventory, and I saw the harm that I've caused, and my sobriety depends on my setting some of this stuff right. It'd be a great favor to me if you would take this money for the shoplifting that I did, and if you need to call the police, you can do that. I'm willing to suffer any consequences because I'm not a free man unless I do this. And, you know, I went through those experiences, and then walking out of the door, you know, I went back fishing one time. You know, I stayed in the fishing industry, but I just stayed shoreside because I knew that I just didn't want to lose this connection I had to AA. But one of the jobs I had, they said, we can keep you working shoreside, you'll be in management and helping to work on the boat stuff, but you need to go up and kind of learn this operation that we've got here. So I went to Alaska. And it was kind of a broken trip. I spent a lot of time up there, you know, several months up there. And I came back, and it sounds like a lot of money, but for the kind of trip and the amount of time and stuff, it wasn't. But I came back, and there was one guy that I owed $14,000 out of, and I had totally been, you know, it was a total dishonest deal where I went to this guy because I knew he just got a large amount of money. And I went to him and gave him the story that I need this, I need first and last, and I need to pay off these debts and stuff. And then I've got this other money coming, and I'm going to pay you back. And he was like, well, how much do you need? And I don't know what came to me, but I just thought, well, I can't use too round of a number. It won't sound real. So I told him, well, probably, you know, like 14 grand. And then I thought he'd say, listen, I can give you $1,000 or something. But the guy gave me $14,000 when I was totally in my cups. And just, you know, being a good guy, but he wasn't exactly a a great guy to owe money to either, you know. So, but he had a lot of money. And so, but I went up to do that trip and I came back and my check for the whole time I was gone, they took all the deductions for everything, was $14,000, mm-hmm. almost $14,000 even. And I was living at my sponsor's car lot. And, you know, and I wanted to get out of that car lot. You know, I wanted to, like, get a place to live, and I wanted to get a car to drive, and I wanted to, you know, be able to do some things. And, but I had that, and I had that debt, and I was listening to these guys, you know, talk about the freedom that they got from making their amends. And I just went to them. I just went to this guy's name was Jake, and I went to Jake and told him, you know, I got that. Sorry, I'm a little late, you know, like 9 months later or a year and a half later, whatever it was. And I paid him that money back and I had nothing, you know, for all that. And, but I don't remember thinking about it like that, but in so much of this is in retrospect as you stay sober and you do these things and then you get to look back on, you know, this wasn't that long ago, like a few years ago, I had this realization. You know what that was? That was the first time in my life I ever put my relationship with God ahead of money. That's what that was about. Like, I got totally free of that. And, you know, gosh, I just got so many things I could say, and I'm 26 minutes into the talk, so I think I'll wrap it up, but... you know, one of the things that, you know, it's like these realizations that you have later. I guess I'll close with this: is that, you know, I really, and again, you know, Bill and we rode down here together, and I was talking to him a little bit about the spiritual experience, but you know, I really believe that for a certain type of alcoholic, you know, it's the spiritual awakening or you're not going to stay sober. I mean, there is no other substitute. That's the way it was for me, you know, and it's that the terms might be different for different people who come into AA, but those were the terms for me, was that I had to have one of these spiritual awakenings, and I was promised that if I went through the steps and adhered to all those things, that I would have one of these things, and that it would, you know, be freedom. And, but I feel like there's a piece in here about a guy named Carl Jung, this famous doctor that started Jungism, and most therapists, I think today, you would know probably, but I think Jungism is still taught in colleges today, right? Yeah. So, yeah, you know, so he was a very famous guy, but he had this deal that I think he called it a spiritus contra spiritum, which meant that you know, alcoholics drink the spirits as a substitute. This is the substitute for the actual spiritual experience. You know, we substitute the booze and the drugs and put all this stuff in. So really, you know, I think that I was a seeker all along. I just was seeking in all the wrong places, and I used to think that oh my God, if I could get if somebody, you know, I'd be in these sleazy motel rooms really late at night, I'd see the preacher on TV, and I would fall victim to it a little bit because I was so desperate, you know, and I would see this, and I would just think, and I would see him, he'd be like, "Demon of alcohol, be gone," and he hit somebody on the forehead, and over they'd go, and flop around, and then they'd jump up, and yay, man, back and forth on the stage they'd go. And I was just thinking, I mean, that's how desperate I was. I just thought, if somebody would get a hold of me and just hit me like that, and knock those demons or whatever out of me, and I could go over, and then I'd wake up in that obsession to destroy myself with booze and drugs and be gone. And I could take a deep breath, you know, wouldn't that be amazing? My mom has been really into this, you know, she has a guru, this guru's name was Ram Dass, and she was a Ram Dass devotee for a long time, including still, even though he's passed on now, But she would tell me about, you know, the mantra, you know, that somebody will come and whisper the sweet mantra in your ear. And when they whisper that in your ear, then you don't tell anybody about it. You can't tell anybody what it is. But it's your deal when you're in trouble and things are getting rough and there's rough going. You know the mantra. And you say the mantra and it kind of brings you out of that. And I had that realization. That's what happened to me in AA. When I came into AA, that meeting at Fremont Hall that night, there was a guy there, Matt. And Matt was the first guy I walked in, and he came over to me and said, "Hey, I'm Matt, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous," and shook my hands. That was the touching, that was the... And then they gave me the mantra. You know, the mantra is, "My name is Kenny, and I am an alcoholic." And that is that. That's a sweetness to that, and I'm not supposed to tell you my mantra, but I'm going to reveal it tonight. That's my mantra. Thank you so much for having me down here.
Thank you.